between them.
You just speak to that part about flight and the donors business.
Well, I, of course, was unaware that the president had made any such request that there be a cooling off period or cessation of demonstrations. I do know that in August, Roy Wilkins, executive secretary of the NAACP, called a meeting of the heads of the various civil rights organizations in his office. And at that time, Mr. Wilkins offered a statement which he had prepared that attacked the white backlash, stated concern about it, stated concern about Goldwater and Goldwaterism, the threat of Goldwater particularly, and stated that we would have a moratorium on demonstrations until after the election. I refused to sign such a statement.
I remember that fact, yes.
Declined to sign it on several grounds. One, I was not convinced that the so-called white backlash was a significant factor, or would be a significant factor in the election. I did not believe that any substantial number of white citizens who formerly were for the civil rights movement were now against it. What I thought had happened was that people who had been against it all along had now become more vocal and articulate. And that some who had been apathetic now were becoming antipathetic, you might say. The second, I did not consider it good tactic or strategy to announce to opponents that you are giving up your most potent weapon. So I declined to sign. John Lewis of SNCC declined to sign also.
Yes, I remember that.
The statement was issued, however. There had been claims made subsequently that Johnson had asked for such a moratorium, but I've seen no verification of that.
And you have seen no verification of a pressure on white donors to civil rights organizations?
No, I have no evidence that there has been any such pressure. I will say that there has been a slight decline in the funds coming in to organizations. And I have no explanation for that.
A question, it may not be an appropriate question, but it's frequently said that an unhealthy amount, it would be a little bit healthy if there were somewhat more Negro money in the pot, in the general civil rights pot. That's said very frequently.
Yeah.
It's a matter of how do you react to that,
well,
that notion?
I think it would be healthier. I think we ought to get money from all sources, white and Negro. But it has been one of the tragedies of the civil rights movement that Negroes have contributed so little in terms of funds to support the movement. There are many reasons for that. There has not been a tradition of giving within the Negro community. There's been a tradition of receiving instead. Second, we in CORE raise about 80% of our budget through direct mail appeals. And replying to direct mail appeals requires a relatively high degree of sophistication and stability. One has to have a permanent address and stay there for a period of time and have a bank account so that he can send in a check and so forth. So that's not conducive to large-scale Negro giving. Well, I read it with much interest, and I find it basically sympathetic and good. My big concern is that CORE seems to be mentioned as an afterthought rather than as an integral part of the summer project. CORE has had rather large-scale activities in Mississippi since the Freedom Rides in the summer of 1964.
I'll take care of that.
Yes. Matter of fact, Schwerner and Cheney were CORE staff members, and the 4th Congressional District, where Neshoba County is, Marion County, are CORE territory, and the people there are CORE, and we've had dozens of workers working in the 4th Congressional District largely, and the CORE field secretary in charge of Mississippi, Dave Dennis, has worked as Bob Moses' assistant program director of COFOR. So CORE was in COFOR at the very beginning, and It was not a question, as far as we're concerned, of our not being able to pull out, because Stick had taken the initiative. We were in from the very beginning and had no intentions of pulling out.
What about the matter of the effect of the summer project? How do you assess the short-range and long-range effects?
Well, I think the greatest effect was in giving the Negro community a sense of not being alone, that there were people outside who were interested. Another important effect was on the students who went down there in the summer. They saw the horrors at first hand and will not be the same again, and will, I believe, be intimately involved with the movement from now on. In terms of numbers of people registered, there's very little. That is not significant.
Dr. Henry said it's around 400. Other people have said it's as high as 12 or 1,300 actual registrations. He wrote to me in his foreword his estimate.
Yeah.
As low as that.
That would be closer to our estimate, too.
400.
Yes, around 400.
Nothing really matters, that kind of margin.
No.
I'm told by people who have worked fairly closely with the student movement, have been there for 2 years, and that there was real resistance last winter on the part of the SNCC people to taking, and some other people in the civil rights movement in Mississippi, to taking on any substantial number of white students.
There was some resistance to that, partly because of the new desire for self-expression on the part of Negroes and sense of identity and race pride and that sort of thing.
Yes.
You know, similar to the nationalist emotional sentiment. And I think it was more than that. There was the fear that the white students would be better educated, better skilled, and so forth.
Just like Bob Moses was telling me last
year. Yes, there was that fear. A result of the Summer Project, and this was somewhat unfortunate, I think, was that the project did not involve local people. In fact, in many cases, local people who had been involved in the movement pulled out when they saw these skilled youngsters from the north coming down. They couldn't type that well and couldn't write or read that well. So they pulled out and said, perhaps they don't need me, and didn't come around.
Now, this applied both to Negro and white outsiders coming in. Any different stories on that, you see?
Well, it applied mostly to the whites, because the Negroes coming in did not have, on an average, the same educational and skills qualifications that the white youth did. But it did apply to them to some degree. Now, we find that after the students have left the summer, some of the local people are coming around again and saying, well, maybe you need me again.
Let's go back to convention for a moment. I have had an account from various people, but you have to patch these things together. Did you see that? It's only a matter of a half a page. Well, I won't. What I have to be accurate is the main point. And I'm not dwelling on it. This is just sort of a footnote. You see, this whole thing is a little footnote.
Yeah.
What was the pressure to accept the compromise that was finally offered?
Well, there was no pressure on me, and I did not ask them to accept the compromise at all. I pointed out that I thought that the FDP's position in rejecting the compromise was morally right but politically wrong. And they had to make a decision on whether they wanted to be moral on this issue or whether they wanted to be political. I felt also that the compromise could have been made more acceptable. I think you indicate that in your notes here. If the Credentials Committee had not selected the two people who would be seated at large, because Negroes' predictable reaction was, we've spent too many years having white people pick our leaders for us.
It's tactless, to say the least.
Certainly. But I'm told that there was considerable pressure from the labor movement and from Senator Humphrey, labor movement through Walter Reuther, and then Senator Humphrey. Presumably this came directly from the administration. And we found, after this pressure was applied from whatever source, that the support that we had in the Credentials Committee for the Green resolution, Edith Green's
yes.
resolution, evaporated, and the commitments that we had gotten, I spent a great deal of time speaking before delegations from various states, urging them to do two things. One, to support the Edith Green proposal, and two, to support roll call, vote on it, and get a floor fight. But we found that the commitments that we had gotten on that
saying that you had a strong support of the Edith Green proposal.
Yes. You know the Edith Green proposal.
Yes, I do. Yes.
The loyalty oath be given
yes.
to all, and those who took it be seated. We've gotten commitments from a number of the delegations, state delegations, that they would support that proposal and that they would support a roll call on the floor, get a floor fight. We had enough to be assured of it.
The Credentials Committee?
Yes, yes. But this support evaporated after the pressure was applied.
Now, Dr. Henry says he, throughout, had been strongly pulling for hearing from all of the leaders of the various civil rights organizations who wanted to speak before a vote was taken. But the vote was not, this was not done, but the vote was taken before there had been a chance for the leaders of the various organizations to express themselves and discuss the matter before body of the representatives of the Freedom Democratic Party.
That is correct. The first vote was taken quickly. The motion was made by Bob Moses.
Yes.
And he insisted upon a quick vote on it rather than a delay. And it was just 2 or 3 minutes after this vote was taken, which was overwhelmingly to reject the compromise, that we learned that Governor Johnson of Mississippi had rejected the compromise and had ordered his delegates to pack up and come home. It may have been, I don't know, this is purely speculative, that if there had been a slight delay in the vote and we had learned of Johnson's, Governor Johnson's actions before the vote was taken, that the Freedom Democratic Party decision might have been different.
Well, one of the SNCC people tells me that it was not known at the time of this vote that the support in the Credentials Committee had evaporated.
Well, there were indications that it was evaporating.
But it had been
not completely evaporated at the time. But we knew that the pressure was on, and we knew that the people were yielding to that pressure.
Well, I understand, too, that, for instance, when the compromise was offered, that Carmichael's, Dr. Carmichael, said in public, outdoor, outside on the, you know, the group outside, this proves that the liberal Democrats are as racist as any Goldwater. This is heat of passion.
Yes, that undoubtedly was heat of passion. And I don't think Stokely would try to defend that position.
Well, my guess is he wouldn't.
Yeah.
But the point is I'm getting at is this. By some accounts, that there's been a great hardening of attitude since the convention among the people who were active in Mississippi. I
This is given to me by various SNCC workers who agree about this fact that Nova tells you to go it alone, to cut off from outside support, a growing suspicion of the white, quotes, liberal Democrat.
All part of the SNCC people, you mean?
This is said about SNCC people, about SNCC people, by SNCC workers to me.
Yeah.
Now, there's no way to actually be asking, I am asking Bob Moses some of these same questions. But I'll be doing that. I couldn't see him. He's in town before he left. But
right.
I'm going to get in touch with him again. I am talking, corresponding with him now. Do you have any impression of that sort? But this, the convention really had a, and the Mississippi whole business had a hardening effect on a sense of withdrawal from the, from white contact, white support.
Well, there is a growing feeling, and it was growing before the convention, but perhaps was accelerated by the events at the convention, that we have no friends. I find this among the younger people, especially in the South, the younger Negroes, that there are no real friends who will stand up when the chips are down. Yet it's contradictory in a way, because the same people who adopt that position spend a great deal of time raising their funds in the North from white liberal sources. Money is given to support the campaign in the South. We find, incidentally, that many white liberals will give much more readily to support Mississippi than they will to support any activities in the North, because it's way down yonder and it's always easier to slay cobras in Borneo.
That's right. But the go it alone attitude is coming, is hardening out, you think, to some degree, particularly among the young.
It is, yes. But I think they're smart enough to know that they can't support the movement without the help of such people.
Now, another thing that seems to come out of Mississippi, I haven't been there in quite some months now, I'm going back in very soon now, but is this, the report, is this real split has developed. I suppose it's a natural split between, say, the theorizers of the movement, chiefly the young SNCC people, but including some others too, and of the rank and file, particularly native Mississippians, who have practical objectives. They just want to be shot, or you know, they want a job, you know, the practical, pragmatic approach, as opposed to the high theorizing of the local, you know, the local brass, the high command.
Yep.
And this split has become more and more marked.
Mm-hmm.
One thing being the notion of the association of the movement in Mississippi with the peasant revolt, the worldwide land drive, and these things.
Yes.
That kind of theorizing.
Yeah. There is such a division developing, and it's shaping up as a division between the large group of staff people who have been the movement in Mississippi over the summer, and the local Negro community. Local Negro community is not at all interested in the theorizing, and at this juncture sees no real identification between their struggle and the struggle in Vietnam or anyplace else in the world. All they want is a right to vote and right to a decent job and a decent house and not to be pushed around.
This goes back to the matter of the screening of the summer workers at Oxford, Ohio, or the lack of screening by all accounts. That Francis Halvorsam, who covered this for the Times, and his pieces, some of the pieces were not published, he has told me about, given me access to this information. He said there was no screening, and he was very disturbed about some of the types who admitted.
He said it had been a, this is a matter of policy, too.
Yeah.
It's really a matter of policy. And it's now reflected in this other alienation, you see, that I'm talking about.
Well, I won't comment on the types who were represented during the summer project, but I will state that there should have been more screening. And if there are any subsequent projects, then there ought to be more screening. In the Freedom Rides, we tried to screen our people very well.
Yes.
We found it difficult, however, after it became a mass movement.
Sure.
But screening is absolutely essential. Some of the conflicts, some of the tensions could have been avoided. I would say also that there was inadequate organization in the summer project. The chains of command and who makes what decisions and that sort of thing. But the thing happened so fast and was so large.
Yes, a thing like that is not subject to military discipline. It has its own, it takes its own shape, more or less.
Yeah.
I think anyone would not realize that problem. One other thing that I get, again, from actual workers, not from random gossip, but there's been a tendency in the growth of the Freedom and Democratic Party to have more and more sort of manipulation from above rather than actual democratic procedure in the whole operation of the party in Mississippi. Now this is, I say this comes from actual workers, not from some say it's natural and some deplore it.
Well, I think both things are true. It may be natural and it still might be deplored. I think that you'll find the same thing in the major parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, that there's a great deal of manipulation from the top rather than real grassroots participation.
Sure, that's perfectly true.
And I think it's true in the Freedom Democratic Party, too. I think that the decision-making procedures have not been clearly enough drawn up to allow for the grassroots participation.
Let's turn to the matter of the segregationist resistance in Mississippi. There have been a series of indications that there are cracks developing in the resistance. This is yesterday in the Times. There was a story by the head of the press, the Mississippi State Press Organization, saying, now is the time to look at ourselves for a change. Find out what's really wrong with us.
Yes.
Us being the Mississippi power structure, said, we can't trust these people running the state now. He said as much, he said them so many words. Are these various indications, like the McComb statement, how much importance do you attach to these indications now?
I attach a great deal of importance to it. It was Ralph McGill who said several years ago that he felt segregation and discrimination would come to an end when American business insisted that it be halted. And I think that's true in Mississippi. It's significant that McComb, the two men who took the lead in getting this statement out, signed by 655 white citizens down, were bankers. And obviously they were concerned that money wasn't coming into the town. That has been the case wherever there has been racial tension.
The whole state's down.
The whole state is suffering
rapidly.
Yeah. I think that we'll find this crack widening even more when and if the federal government follows through on Title VI of the 64 Civil Rights Act and withholds funds from projects and programs that discriminate. That'll be practically all of the projects and programs in Mississippi, now subsidized by the federal government. Even more when they really feel the pinch on nationwide boycotts. Now, the position we've taken on boycotts and, in Mississippi is that we don't want across-the-board boycott. We want to use two things. We want to use a stick and a carrot as well. So I'm sending a letter today to businesses, at least 100 of the major businesses in Mississippi, pointing out the horrors that have taken place in that state, and pointing out their responsibility as financial leaders of the state to do something about it, and asking them specifically what steps they are taking, have taken, or plan to take in the following fields: employment of Negroes in all levels in their company, securing of effective, equal, and responsible law enforcement in the community in which they operate, a statewide climate of acceptance of the mandates of the United States Constitution. And we are asking to hear from them on that. If we get an unfavorable reply, unresponsive reply, or no reply at all, then there will be a boycott against those specific companies. But we will exempt those companies that are doing something.
Instead of an across-the-board
boycott. Instead of an across-the-board boycott, which does not allow anybody any out, they might as well join forces then with the segregationists for mutual defense.
Tell me this, what are the chances, do you think, psychologically, of a crack in the arrest of the 21 who stand in, accused with the FBI participation in that? This is guesswork, but what about public opinion swinging toward actual indictment? Or is that too tight? Is the shoulder too tight for that?
I think that there is a possibility of an indictment because of, excuse me, that's it, yes, there's a possibility of an indictment because of the desire of Mississippi to get off the hook and to escape the economic pressure from without and to improve its public relations image generally. It's tending to feel isolated now, feel that it's becoming an island and that the rest of the country is pointing at it. So I think there is a possibility of a murder charge being filed by the state and an indictment gotten. I am not optimistic about the chances for conviction, because here you would have to have 12 Mississippi jurors voting unanimously. Yeah. The best we could hope for, I think, is a hung jury.
Mm-hmm. What about the notion that I've tried to develop there, which has struck me in the last few months, about the Mississippi being off balance now, off stance? They've broken the basic technique of a power structure, boys, to keep up order and segregation together. They try to keep order and have segregation. Well, now this blew up during the summer of bad. Before this, most of the violence had been got violent somehow, geared to under the auspices of order or law. Now it's blown up entirely with the rise of the Klan, this big Neshoba thing and the rest of it. Does that make any sense to you? But they are now off balance, that they have no way to get back on balance.
Well, I'll cut it off just a moment. I don't think there's ever really been order in Mississippi. The difference, a big difference, is that now the spotlight of public attention is on the state. In the past, there have been murders. The Klan has risen. There have been burnings and bombings and that sort of thing. But it has not been widely publicized. Medgar Evers told me just a month before his death that it was not extraordinary for a body to come floating down the Pearl River or the Mississippi or the big Black River, or for some Negro who'd been involved in the movement to have a weird freak accident on the highway and go off an embankment or over a bridge or something. So this was not extraordinary, but now when these things happen, the whole nation and the whole world knows about it. Nor do I think that the extreme racists, the Klan, and so forth, has become more active now. I think they always have been active, and my impression is that there has been an alliance between the law enforcement officers and these groups, the vigilante groups, to maintain order. And order, according to their definition, was quiescence on the part of the Negroes and acquiescence, acceptance. But certainly there can no longer be that in Mississippi or any place else in the South now. And this has been a major point of the movement, to make it clear that there cannot be order and peace without justice.
If Mississippi cracks, you think the whole thing will crack all across the Deep South?
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. I think that we'll have to do battle in Louisiana, as we are doing battle in Louisiana now. For the past 2 years, without much publicity, we've had 30, 40, and 50 staff members working the whole state of Louisiana. And this summer, we plan to be stepping that up. I don't expect that the other hardcore areas, Alabama, most of Louisiana, southwest Georgia, northern Florida, will fall automatically if Mississippi falls. I think that we'll have to struggle county by county, city by city, town by town, state by state.
What about the debt theory, there being a debt owed to the, because of slavery, to Negroes, as distinguished from simply ordinary programs for education and apply across the board, irrespective of ethnic or other considerations. A notion of moral debt to the Negro American because his great grandfather was once a slave.
I'm not impressed with that argument, and I've heard a great deal of it. I am impressed with an argument that is closely related to that, however, that because of the past and present discrimination against Negroes, a special effort has to be made now.
That's different, though.
Yeah, that's different.
That would apply to a man of any complexion or any ethnic origin.
That's right. If you've been discriminated against and deprived, then the society has a responsibility to help upgrade you.
All poor and deprived people
white,
are
black.
That's about a citizen's right and not a debt for the grandfather.
No, I don't believe in this genetic guilt and that sort of thing.
Of course, that theory is a split right down the middle of, the world. Dr. King, you see, is all this, the debt theory, you see, the moral justification.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's back and forth, there's no agreement on that.
Yeah, well, I believe in moral justification of what we're doing, but I put it in the basis of the present rather than slave period.
How do you react to Mr. Ruskin's notion that the movement now is really a catalytic agent, one might say, for a big social movement that's about to come? The Negroes' activities are kind of a pilot operation, a kind of catalytic agency for a big social revolution in order with automation and other technological changes.
Well, I think certainly the Negro Revolution going side by side with the Negro Revolution, and at some point they'll have to get together. And in a sense, they have gotten together in the war on poverty. Johnson's anti-poverty program. But the fact of the matter is that most of our activists throughout the country do not perceive of themselves as leading or serving as catalysts in any general social movement. They are interested in their problem primarily. If a man is in a cave confronted with a tiger, he is not going to be very much concerned about the lion that's wandering around outside in the woods. He's going to be preoccupied with this tiger.
Yeah.
I think that's true of the people who are involved in our movement, by and large.
But there are two lines of theorizing that go to lead that position, of course. One being that when the world, you know, the peasant revolution, the world revolution, all of that, the Vietnam stuff, and the other being the big overhaul of American society, which is presumably a catalytic and a pilot. But you answered the question.
I would add something to it,
yeah.
To the answer, however. I'd say that there is a growing awareness in the civil rights movement now that our problems are not simple, that they're complex, that they're involved with economic structure and with the problems of other minority groups and with politics. For that reason, we are expanding our program, we're broadening it. We are insisting upon more political involvement on the part of our chapters and our members on a precinct level. Perhaps free and democratic clubs, such as now organized in Illinois, where we can help to determine candidates and put up candidates and lobby to get them nominated by the major parties. We will try to do less of speaking at the power structure, talking at them, and then protesting the decisions after the decisions are made. We'll try to help determine the makeup of the power structure and be in on the decision-making in that manner. We'll also broaden our program economically, which means two things. One, greater use of the economic weapon to achieve our objectives of boycott, patronage, withholding, selective buying, and so forth. Two, it means an attempt to upgrade economically the Negro community, the ghetto. We realize the ghetto is going to be with us for a long time. Even if Negroes have the freedom to move out, to move elsewhere, many will stay there voluntarily and others will stay because they're locked in economically, even if there's no discrimination elsewhere. So we've got to upgrade it economically, and this means co-ops, it means credit unions, it means pooling of resources to start businesses and industries and that sort of thing. Not in the way the black nationalists speak of it as a rival economy, but in the sense of urging Negroes to participate fully in every aspect of American life. Third, educational. We realize that even if we wipe out discrimination tomorrow, we might have achieved the freedom, by which we mean freedom to make meaningful choices in housing and jobs and schools and so forth. But we will not have achieved equality, which is essential to fully utilizing that freedom. So we are pressing hard for a remedial education program. Massive in scope by the federal government. If it is not done by the federal government, then we'll do it ourselves on as large a scale as our resources allow. Yeah, I think it's absolutely necessary. If a youngster can't read, you're not going to be able to retrain him to fit into an automated industry.
What's the next general move aside from what you just said in terms of the
of civil, not civil rights now, but the general movement. You've been talking about the economic side of it. What else do you see as crucial or as important? Well, that really make for integration. What does integration really mean in your long range idea? What is the content of worry to you?
Yeah.
Well, what kind of world are you envisage?
What we mean by integration, an integrated society or an open society, first I can tell you what we don't mean. We do not see a society in which Negroes will be absorbed and will disappear as Negroes lose their identity completely. I think that's not possible. It's not in the American tradition, nor is it desired by most Negroes. There is now a growing awareness and self-identity among Negroes, and this would run counter to it. What we do see is a freedom to make meaningful choices. That is, no racial restrictions on where a person might live. If one wants to live any place in the city or in the suburbs, he should be able to live there if he has the money to pay for the housing that's available. In terms of jobs, the same thing would be true. If he has the skills and the qualification, he should be able to work at any job without any restrictions on him. So it would be a permissive society in that way. But I do not see it as a society in which Negroes would lose their identity. I think that Negroes could only come into an integrated society as an equal, proud and equal partner, who are proud of their own heritage and traditions and subculture, and come in because they have something to give and something to share, and are willing to receive what others have to give. And this pride does not mean, in my judgment, a rejection of the contributions which others have made, nor does it mean a counter-hate.
How much of this withdrawal we have talked about in amongst some of the people in Mississippi, the going along, the hardening up of attitude, the growing suspicion of any white or cooperation, or the suspicion of any white sincerity, how widespread is that, do you think? This is a growing sentiment. You sense it as a growing sentiment?
Well, I would say a growing sentiment, but only among the staff people. I don't see it as a significant feeling among the rank and file Negroes in Mississippi or any place else. But you must remember that the operation this summer, and this is one of its weaknesses, was largely staff operation, if you consider the volunteers as staff, and was not an operation involving the people of the community to any great extent. People in the community don't have to go it alone attitude now. The pros do.
Does that seem realistic to you,
going it alone? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. There is no hope in a go it alone policy as far as the Negro in this country is concerned, in my opinion. I do agree with Rustin on this point that we've got to have allies. There must be allies. I don't agree with him in his insistence that we've got to make power allies of labor and that sort of group, because if we form an alliance, a formal alliance, with the AFL-CIO or individual unions, we'll be junior partners in such an alliance because they have. And this I would not accept.
It's
far as I can make out, there's a, I would say in the last 5 years, there's been a real change in awareness and attitude among a large number of the white people I'm acquainted with in one way or another. A sense of growing urgency with this matter has to be solved, and solved with some justice and some human recognition. This is my range of observation. So seeing this among the people that I see, or even have slight acquaintance with, I mean people who were 10 years ago have been segregationists, put on one hand over against the going along, the hardening attitude among certain Negroes. I see this as a kind of a sort of built-in necessity, I guess, in the historical moment. But I do feel it.
I think you're right in your judgment there. I think that there is that sentiment among whites, and it's a fairly general feeling. I'm sure that this is because of the pressure that we've maintained through demonstrations and so forth. And I also know from my little study of history that people's memories are very short, and I fear that this sentiment will die down if the pressure is removed. And this is one reason CORE cannot, could not during the summer, and cannot now have a moratorium on demonstrations.
Some people, of course, say the demonstrations in the North won't work. It's really a comedy, a southern operation. They don't have the effect in the North because the targets are too amorphous.
Well, this I would say is nonsense. Really, in California, our CORE chapters, there are 26 or 28 chapters out there. They had a statewide campaign against discrimination in the Bank of America, the biggest bank in the country, if not in the world, involving demonstrations, picket lines, sit-ins, and so forth. They won. They won 8,000 new jobs for Negroes, and this is a victory. And there have been other such victories in stores, Safeway stores, A&P stores, and other companies. We had a boycott here with demonstrations 2 years ago against a brewery company, and it was victorious. It won. So the demonstrations work if they are focused, but obviously they're more complicated here. We've had demonstrations in housing that have won. One minor victories, such as opening up one apartment house or housing development to Negroes. And they've been carried out successfully by sit-in demonstrations. So the demonstrations work. I don't see a demonstration as a rabbit's foot, however, or as a fetish. But I'm not a dogmatist there. But wherever you have a problem, you wave the rabbit foot and the problem somehow disappears. The demonstration has to be geared to the nature of the problem. The tactic that you use has to be so geared.
I was talking the other day to Mr. Myers. He's a professor of sociology at Yale. He said as far as he could now see, that we are doomed to a 6% sort of blank population, that the people can't take care of themselves, never be absorbed economically or socially. And this is not a question of race. This is a call. Just a 6% dead weight. But this will gradually level that group and gradually raise, I think, just by some of the
aimless American goodwill may raise a little bit, you know, subsidize it. But he said there's not no indication she would ever get a lower figure than that as of now.
Well, and typically, as of now, that is if we don't use some different methods to try to elevate them, I think he's right. But I don't think that we can afford to rely upon aimless American goodwill to elevate them. I think we have to have a crash program aimed at that as a part of the anti-poverty campaign. And this is why I'm so much interested in a remedial education program that's massive. Not only to teach people how to read, but teach them the elemental principles, what they mean, and to teach them to comprehend when they read. And this can be done. We have techniques now that have